not just the municipalities, it's the taxpayers who are forced to make this payment to support the state obligation.
The Ketchikan Gateway Borough's lawsuit against the state over education funding is heard in court. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Pavlov volcano is rumbling yet again.
The onset on Saturday was fairly abrupt and didn't have much, if any, seismic precursory activity. We simply saw it in satellite imagery.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Finding the time for physical activity after school, homework, and dinner can be tough, but you can make it a priority to stay healthy as a family. Go for a bike ride, take a walk around the neighborhood, or play a game of basketball with your kids. Get active, get moving, and have fun as a family. Inspire your kids to get out and play 60 minutes every day. For more ways to get physically active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Judge William Carey heard oral arguments in Ketchikan Superior Court yesterday in the Ketchikan Gateway Borough's lawsuit against the state over education funding. KRBD's Maria Dudzak has this report.
The lawsuit challenges the state over what some local officials say is an unfair mandate requiring boroughs and first-class cities, but not others, to fund a minimum level for local schools. The borough argues that because not everyone in Alaska is required to contribute to local education, the mandate is not fair. The borough filed the suit in early January. In February, the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly voted to file an amicus brief in support of the Ketchikan borough's argument. Other plaintiffs in the case are Ketchikan residents John Harrington, David Spokley, Agnes Moran, and her minor son, John Koss. Luann Cutler of K&L Gates LLC spoke on behalf of all plaintiffs. Cutler says under the Constitution, the state is required to fund education. She acknowledged that the state is not required to fully fund education, but reiterated that a statute requiring a local contribution from local sources imposes an unfair tax on municipalities.
It's not just the municipalities, it's the taxpayers who are forced to make this payment to support the state obligation. It's clearly a dedicated, earmarked source of state funding, and that's the problem with it. It's not that the state has to fully fund education, it's that it has to fund it in a way that doesn't violate other constitutional provisions.
Cutler says by forcing organized boroughs and cities to dedicate a certain amount to education funding, it's making them tax collectors. A key case being used to support the borough's argument is State v. Alex. The Alaska Supreme Court decision in that case invalidated a state statute authorizing private aquaculture associations to collect fees from commercial salmon fishermen. This was found to be in violation of the Dedicated Funds Clause. Assistant Attorney General Kate Vogel presented the state's argument. Vogel says the local contribution is constitutional because it is not subject to the restrictions that apply to state money, such as legislative approval or dedicated funds prohibition.
This isn't a specific funding source. It's not a specific tax. Instead, it's simply an allocation of responsibility to a local government unit. It is no more a dedication than the portion of that same statute which talks about state aid.
Vogel says if the local contribution was truly state money, the borough would receive 100% of its basic need, and the money would be under the control of the state, which could choose to use it for a purpose other than education. She says local contributions are currently going directly to the school system, and municipalities are deciding how their money is spent. Vogel reiterated that it is not a tax and municipalities could use other means besides taxation to fund the mandate.
It's not about the state imposing a state tax, which clearly it could do, you know, anywhere that it so chose. This is the state cooperating with the local communities and requiring that they themselves exercise their taxing authority or, you know, whatever other means that they use to come up with a certain amount. But certainly the state isn't dictating a specific tax.
Judge Carey responded.
To my knowledge, every municipality or borough that contributes this contribution does it through taxes. I mean, they're not getting it from the bingo hall.
Monday's court appearance is the sole time oral arguments will be heard. The case is now in the hands of Judge Carey. It may be months before a decision is reached. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
Pavlov volcano is erupting on the Alaska Peninsula. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
The volcano's ash plume is up to 18 to 20,000 feet today. That's put local airlines on alert. Pan Air spokeswoman Missy Roberts says the ash hasn't caused problems for any flights just yet. Planes made it in and out of Sand Point last night and Cold Bay this morning.
All of our flights are currently on schedule. However, our dispatch and operations continues to monitor the situation on an hourly, if not even more so, basis. And for the safety of our passengers and our operation, we will make changes as needed at that time.
She says they're looking for changes in the wind that could send ash into the way of Pan Air's planes. The ash is a safety risk and can damage the aircraft.
Whether it's hanging out over one of our stations or one of our alternates, you know, if we have the ability to be able to go around it, if we don't, we're certainly not going to go through it.
Right now, Alaska Volcano Observatory scientist Game McJimsey says most of Pavlov's ash plume is being blown south, out to sea and away from flight paths and towns. Lower-level winds at around 5 to 10,000 feet are carrying ash west toward Cold Bay. There haven't been reports of ash fall yet, but McJimsey says that could change.
If there is an ash fall today, it would likely occur in Cold Bay and it would be very, very light.
The AVO first put Pavlov on watch on Saturday. McJimsey says its activity escalated quickly, but that's not unusual for this volcano.
The onset on Saturday was fairly abrupt and didn't have much, if any, seismic precursory activity. We simply saw it in satellite imagery. And yesterday, about 3 p.m., was when the seismicity took an abrupt uptick, and that was commensurate with photographs from Cold Bay residents showing the plume had greatly increased in height and intensity.
There was also glowing lava visible from Cold Bay last night, fountaining out of the volcano's crater and flowing down its north flank. McJimsey says there's no telling how long this eruptive period will last. This time 1 year ago, Pavlov erupted for several weeks, sending ash up to 28,000 feet and stranding hundreds of air travelers. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Strong earthquake activity continued in the far northwest corner of the Brooks Range today after a powerful 4.6 jolt was recorded Thursday and was followed by more seismic activity this week. In all, it's the third in what's now a series of strong quakes followed by potent aftershocks in the last 2 months.
This one almost exactly in the same area, so this one was another large aftershock.
That's Natasha Rupert, a seismologist with the Alaska Earthquake Center in Fairbanks. She says Thursday's 4.6 magnitude aftershock struck in the evening about 18 miles northeast of the community of Noatak. It was a reminder of the powerful tremor felt back in April, which was the strongest quake in the region in more than 30 years. Last Thursday's aftershock was followed by two new earthquakes on Monday. Even more were recorded this morning, a 3.1, the latest, shaking the seismic scales that were installed in Kotzebue and Nome after the May quake.
We are able to tell now with new equipment, we are actually seeing that if these events are a little bit more shallower, closer to the surface than what we thought before, we are able actually to compute locations for these earthquakes much more accurately.
Rupert says the remote nature of the far western Brooks Range means there's still no firm scientific consensus for what faults are causing earthquakes and other tectonic activity in western Alaska. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the growth of heroin use in the Matsu Valley.
If we can link a theft to a person, normally that person is a known drug user.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at Alaska.BP.com.
A jump in property thefts in Matanuska Valley communities spurred the Alaska State Troopers to start a new crime suppression unit in Palmer this year. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, property crimes in the valley may be linked to the increased use of drugs like heroin, and the trend upward of both drug use and property crimes has social costs that have yet to be tallied.
The new Alaska State Trooper unit began operations on January 1st and made its first arrests that same day when a pair of 22-year-olds smashed into a business and tried to grab an ATM machine. So-called smash and dash thefts are escalating in the valley, thefts of TVs, snow machines, computers, and guns. The thefts involve home break-ins. What is sparking the crime wave? Trooper Sergeant Tony Wegson says it's drugs.
If we can link a theft to a person, normally that person is a known drug user. Very seldom do we find a person who's just stealing to steal. Normally they're stealing to support a habit of some sort.
Sergeant Wegson is part of the four-man crime unit. He says troopers are linking the thefts to the increased use of heroin in the Mat-Su.
Heroin is becoming more popular in the valley. 10 years ago, you wouldn't have found heroin. Today, it's everywhere.
If you fight property crime, you have to fight the drugs. And the drugs, the heroin usage out here in the valley is astronomical.
Vicki Wallner is one Palmer homeowner who is taking the offensive against the thefts. She's fighting back using a tool that young Alaskans know well, social media. Wallner settles into a chair in her comfortable kitchen. Her house on a two-lane blacktop outside of town is in a peaceful setting. Horses graze in nearby paddocks and chickens cluck in the mid-afternoon sun, but crime is spreading a shadow over this bucolic scene. Wallner says crime and drugs go hand in hand.
We had the neighbors over behind us on the next street had their door kicked in and they were burglarized. And I thought, why don't people in the neighborhood know? Why don't we tell each other what's going on so we can watch out for one another?
She says she's tried to make changes using Facebook.
We have over 5,700 members now. So this is our main page here, and this is a vehicle that stole gas can.
She toggles down the page full of photos, comments, typical social media stuff. Only all of it is directed toward locating stolen property.
We even recovered a semi that had been missing for 4 months. It's amazing when you have that many people, that many eyes and ears out looking for things.
Don Bennis, Executive Director of Alaska Family Services in Palmer, is looking at the social costs of heroin addiction, a drug he says that wasn't even on the counseling services radar 10 years ago.
Alcohol, far and away, is our largest area, and then marijuana certainly is number two. But the one that's really changed over the last few years is heroin use. Heroin use has dramatically increased.
When troopers shut down the meth labs in the valley, drug users turned to the prescription drug OxyContin to stay high. But the expensive opiate OxyContin led to heroin in short order. A report by the Journal of the American Medical Association of Psychiatry found that heroin use in the United States has jumped 80% between 2007 and 2012, and that three-quarters of users live in non-urban locations. Bennis says a lot of people are moving into the valley and they are, quote, bringing their baggage with them. He says his counselors are also noting an influx of girls from stable families coming in for help. He says that the heroin in the valley is cheap. He suspects, purposely so, to get young people involved. But the drug seems to cross all social borders.
Both sexes, we see it in middle-income families, we see it across the board.
He says there are not enough counseling centers in the valley to cover the growing number of cases.
Clearly right now there's not. That's one of the things we're very concerned about. And right now we have about 10, 11 providers in the valley that do behavioral health services. And we're working very hard to coordinate those services to try and meet the new demand.
According to a health scan released last year by the Mat-Su Health Foundation, 36% of Valley High School students have tried marijuana and 3% have tried heroin, according to 2011 statistics, but close to 43% have tried drugs of various kinds, including meth, OxyContin, spice, and cocaine. Recently, troopers arrested a 20-year-old Wasilla man who was providing heroin to juveniles as young as 15. Bennis says teens simply can't handle it.
It affects their brain differently. Their brains aren't totally formed like an adult would be, and it has much more severe impact on them.
The disturbing trend goes beyond personal property losses. For example, a Wasilla gun shop was robbed last winter. Sergeant Wegson says those arms were recovered.
They fall into the wrong hands, and then those guns are then involved in other crimes. And like in the first quarter, we recovered 24 stolen guns. And I'm positive that a large number of those would have never been recovered without this unit being formed, because we have the time to dedicate to actually track those guns down.
Meanwhile, Vicki Wallner continues her crusade to track down stolen property.
Nobody used to like a nosy Nora, but nosy Nora is going to be the one that's going to keep your house from getting broke into.
She says the thieves are keeping up with her Facebook page, too, although they probably don't like what they see there. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Yesterday evening, residents from Kobuk, Shungnak, and Ambler gathered in the Kobuk Community School for meetings about the status of a state-backed industrial road that would pass through the region. But even getting to the meeting presented some challenges.
We had charter flights arranged to bring people from Ambler, and unfortunately, both runways got shut down in Ambler, and our caravans couldn't land, so we had to rely on people boating.
Leslie Lepley works for Dowell HKM, a company contracted by the state to handle many of the logistics of moving the road project forward. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or AIDA, sponsored the meeting. Perspectives on the proposed road remain mixed. Many who spoke support the potential for jobs from road work and at the eventual mining district. Miles Cleveland lives in Ambler and says the region needs jobs to survive.
And we need jobs to continue to pay for our light bills, our water and sewer. Those take money.
AIDA is currently selecting a contractor to begin work on the massive environmental impact study that's part of the federal approval process. Fred Sun is from Shungnak and on the board of directors for the Nana Regional Corporation. He spoke about the need to wait until environmental data is collected to make a decision on whether or not to move forward with the road.
And whether or not your decision is to support this road or go against it, I think it's just as important you support the EIS process, because not only is it going to be useful for the construction of this road, but it'll be useful for other projects in the future.
But while a complete environmental impact study wouldn't be a green light for the road, it's not clear how frequently AIDA or the state's different permitting agencies have shut down development projects that have made it to the EIS stage. Jill Yorty is in charge of mining and clean water programs at the Northern Center in Fairbanks. She says even at this point, the rhetoric from the state is shifting.
And one of my big concerns related to that is that the conversation will then be framed to be what route should the road take, not whether or not there should be a road.
AIDA is hoping to start the EIS process later this summer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Anchorage is celebrating its 10th annual Bike to Work Day tomorrow. The event is aimed at promoting bike commuting in Alaska's largest city. But Bike to Work Day isn't the only time cyclists are on the road in the city. Data from the American Community Survey says bike commuting in Anchorage is up more than 150% since 1990, making it one of the top cities in the nation for bike commuters. KSKA's Ann Hillman took to the trails to find out more.
Jackie Edwards pushes her teal bike up the hill on the Chester Creek Trail toward the bridge over Northern Lights.
I am bike commuting from work. to my house.
It's her first time trying it.
I'm just trying to include a little bit more activity in my life. And I've always wanted to ride my bike to work, but really didn't have the guts. And within the last week or so, I've just decided to give it a shot.
She says, as a beginner, it's exhausting, but worth it.
Yeah, I get to see pockets of my community that I would never ever see driving in my vehicle, so it's great.
Edwards is joining more than 1,800 regular bike commuters in Anchorage. It seems like a small number. It's only 1.1% of all commuters in the city, but it's almost twice the national average. And the number doesn't account for folks who bike other places, like to the grocery store or to volunteer positions like Chris Black.
For me, I like it. It's a really good alternative, and it you could lose a few pounds and stuff like that. So,
Black says he bikes because it's healthy for him. Bill Popp from the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation says it's also healthy for the local economy. Retail sales are up for bikes and bike parts. And Popp says making the community more bike-friendly attracts young professionals and, to a degree, some businesses.
When they're thinking about making an investment in a city, what kind of a cultural and environmental opportunity does that city represent to the workforce that they're going to want to hire, either by importing that workforce or hiring it locally and then retaining it?
But along with all of the positives, there are some negatives. Cyclist and driver Julie Sidoris says she's been almost hit by cars a few times, and sometimes drivers are just rude to her.
Cyclists and cars interact on the road together, and there's a lot of anxiety and frustration on both sides, and I think that improvements could be made to make the two coexist better on the road.
So what's the solution? She says one is increasing awareness. She's proposing a Share the Road specialized license plate to the next legislature. But Bicycle Commuters of Anchorage co-founder Brian Littman says sometimes it's even easier than that. He says reports confirm that there's safety in numbers.
So with more people out bicycling, motorists become more aware and recognize that there's bicyclists on the road. And so I think we're seeing motorists, just the behaviors are starting to change. And I'm seeing a lot more motorists that are recognizing me at crosswalks and waving me through. And that makes it a much safer city to bike in.
Littman says the city also needs better marking and signage on bike lanes and bike routes, so people are more likely to see the cyclists. Back on the trail, Edwards, the first-time bike commuter, says making use of the new perspective of being on a bike helps, too.
I don't know. I think it's interesting. I'm more aware. More aware just paying attention to all the traffic around me versus when I'm, like, you know, in my car. I mean, I pay attention, but I just don't want to get hit. So you have to be more aware.
After her brief rest, she's ready to finish her ride. She hops on her bike and is off. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
There have been some young faces in recent weeks at the Ketchikan shipyard. This spring, Vigor Industrial started a new job training course for high schoolers. Three Ketchikan High School students have stuck with the program. For one of them, working at the shipyard has been especially meaningful. KRBD's Emily Files reports.
This is actually really exciting because I could actually just see it myself right now.
Kayla Del Rosario is looking through the window of an observation deck at the shipyard. She watches as workers slowly reel an Alaska Marine Highway ferry onto the dry dock for maintenance. Right now, Kayla is here as an observer. In about a year, she'll probably be here as an employee.
That's the plan so far, and I'm just going along with it, and actually, I find it really, really cool and exciting.
Kayla is 17 years old, a high school junior. Her interest in a career at the shipyard started when she signed up for welding at K-High because she wanted to have a class with her best friend.
When that class started, I actually started liking welding, and I started getting really good at it. My hands were steady, and I did a little research on how it's a good skill and a job, and it pays well because I kind of live on my own. I moved out when I was 16.
Kayla was born in the Philippines. She was raised by her aunt and uncle, who moved to Ketchikan when she was 5 years old. She says she was always pretty independent. She started working at 14 and paid for some of her own expenses. When she was 16, her aunt and uncle agreed to let her live on her own. She says it helped her take responsibility.
So when I was with my auntie and uncle, I was more like, I don't have to worry about this. I was more interested in hanging out with my friends. Something about paying bills and getting school done kind of did the trick for me to mature up.
Kayla says when she was younger, she would skip out on school to drink or smoke with her friends. When she started living on her own, she focused more on school and her part-time job at a tour company. But she didn't really have a plan for the future. Kayla signed up for welding and loved it. Then she went to a career day at the shipyard last October, and she talked to Doug Ward, who works in business development at Vigor. She told him, I'm really interested in welding, and I want to learn more about working here.
She certainly was the one, we just kept thinking about her. What can we do to get high school kids into the workplace and get them exposed to all of the shipbuilding processes that we do down here?
Kayla's interest is one of the reasons the shipyard put this 8-week program together. Here's the way it works. The high schoolers come to the shipyard for 2 hours, 2 days a week, and they actually get paid to be here, $10 an hour. Each week, they shadow someone in a different department.
My plan was welding, and so far it's still welding, but I do feel like I want to do different kind of departments, and I think it'd be handy to know more than just one. Like, I actually am interested in mechanic now.
When Kayla thinks about where she was her freshman year of high school compared to where she is now,
I'm actually proud of myself for the first time that I got myself out of that life that I used to do and into wanting to do what I've been searching for, something I'm actually passionate about, because I was never passionate about a lot of things.
Vigor is hoping to find more Kaylas, young people in Ketchikan who are interested in this kind of work. They plan to continue the work experience program next year. In Ketchikan, I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Maria Dudzak and Emily Files in Ketchikan, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, Matthew Smith and Zachariah Hughes in Nome, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.